Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Special Access by Mark A. Hewitt, narrated by Gary Bennett. May 1st, 2011. The President announced that the United States conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden. May 5th, 2011. The President announced that he would personally thank the Navy SEAL team that killed Osama bin Laden. For 4 days, the nation was treated to hundreds of stories of SEALs. The public wanted more information about their new heroes. May 7, 2011. Special Operations Command struggled with issuing a press release that Navy SEALs are grateful for the nation's show of support, but are growing angry with the continued focus on their operations, tactics, and tools, claiming it could jeopardize future raids and their safety. Anything further that comes out could damage their operational security, may reveal tricks of the trade, or even endanger their families. May 10, 2011. Pablo Reyes, a 22-year-old retired U.S. Navy commander and former Navy SEAL, was found dead at his home in Denver, Colorado. The Denver Police Department believes Mr. Reyes, a physical fitness instructor at the Johnson & Wales University, was the victim of a random shooting. The case is under investigation. Prologue. 2325 Lima, February 12, 1999, Cristobal Airport, Republic of Panama. As they took turns climbing onto the wing and settling into their cockpits, the two men in black Nomex and black helmets quickly went through their pre-start checks. The man in front lowered the canopy, while the man in black scanned left and right to discern if anyone would notice their late-night departure. It was wasted energy. One of the ground crew had already done that, scanning the area with night-vision goggles. All clear was a thumbs-up held high for 3 seconds, followed by starter engagement and a slowly spinning propeller. It wasn't just any propeller, but one specially designed in the late 60s by an acoustic laboratory in Massachusetts. The prop design was still considered top secret. Also, obviously missing during the engine start sequence was the low growl of engine exhaust. The big Continental 360 should have rattled the windows of nearby buildings during engine start, but it sounded more like a Lionel locomotive. Hot exhaust gases were completely diffused through a pair of large conformal mufflers and long perforated piping that ran down the starboard side of the fuselage. Lycoming engineers found a way to dissipate the hot gases and muffle the engine exhaust. The pilot lowered the canopy, flipped Anvis 9s over his eyes, and silently taxied to the runway. Ready? Ready, all clear. If anyone noticed the little black tail dragger, he would have doubted what he saw and heard. At 1400 RPM, the pitch control lever was smoothly programmed to increase the angle of attack of the propeller to the maximum pitch angle. The special reduction gearbox spun the laminated three-prop blade slowly. The 3-foot rectangular blades cut the air in small gulps with no noticeable P-factor. The last remaining operational YO-3A slowly moved down the runway. A low-noise profile takeoff at night under night-vision goggles is as harrowing as a nighttime catapult launch of an F-4 Phantom off a pitching carrier deck in crappy weather. The pilot had done both multiple times. At the two-board and 35 knots, the tail wheel lifted gently off the centerline at the urging of the pilot's forward cyclic inputs. Taking all 5,000 feet of runway, the mains broke the deck before the asphalt ran out. No one in or near the airport heard or saw the airplane take off. 2 minutes later, at 2,000 feet AGL, Duncan Hunter pushed the throttle to 3,200 RPM to increase climb rate and speed and leveled off the YO-3A on a heading of 080. In the rear seat, Greg Lynch began checking the FLIR, infrared illuminator, laser target designator, and video recorder. "Not bad for a 30-year-old plane," Lynch remarked. "A 30-year-old plane with your basic F-16 cockpit. I'm really impressed with the old girl. You also worked some magic with the engine since last time. We dropped a competition Continental. 2 spares are in the shop getting the same treatment." "The last of its kind. Like your old F-4? Duncan sighed. "That hurt, Greg. Yes, like my old F-4. The last of the man's machines. I hate to say it. They're being converted into drones, and I hate to think they're targets. I love flying this. This is a great airplane in its own way. Surprisingly very responsive. You need a good touch to fly this well. That's why you're flying, and I'm picture-taking. Thank you, sir. Every time I fly this, it's always a little strange having boards for a prop. This is a very cool airplane. Checking their GPS coordinates, Lynch said, Let's head 090 and see if we can find the FARC, take some pictures, and head back. If we have time, I want pictures of the port, the oil tankers and storage tanks, and anything else that might be of interest. The retired CIA chief of Air Branch was back in his element, hunting drug smugglers and narco-terrorists from the formerly top-secret airplane. 11 Lockheed Y-03A prototypes were developed for the U.S. Army's use in Vietnam as low-altitude, silent-night reconnaissance airplanes, derived from several quiet thruster designs that would have given Rube Goldberg a stroke. Number 007 was the last remaining flyable copy in private hands. Less than 12 people knew of its existence. Only 6 knew of 007's capabilities. I still can't get over how you got this from the FBI. Are you sure you didn't hold a gun to someone's head? Made them an offer they couldn't refuse? Something like that. Someone owed me a favor. You know I was the DCI's personal aide. Greg, you rarely tell me anything about your old place. You know, after the judge ran the FBI, he came to CIA as the DCI. I became his aide. Yes, sir, I know that. How'd you get 007? Well, after my tour as the judge's aide, I became chief air branch. Toward the end of my 3 years, I had visions of making the CIA aviation museum on some of the land behind headquarters. I had the last remaining A-12 in storage, along with a U-2 and a DC-3 from our old Air America days. I found out this little recce plane was going to be returned to DOD, and there was little doubt it would be scrapped. So I asked the FBI to transfer 007 when they were done with it. They told me to get bent. The judge found out his old place had basically flipped me off. He made a couple calls, and right before he retired, he somehow had the plane transferred to me. Actually, the FBI sold it to me for $1. Not exactly what I had in mind, but that was the deal. Duncan shook his helmeted head. Do you see that? 1 o'clock on the horizon. Old habits die hard. Lynch couldn't see Hunter's visual vector. What? Where? Looks like a bonfire. It's a little late for a barbecue. Let's go take a look. Take it up to 9,000, and we'll see if that's a good altitude. Hunter traded airspeed for altitude. During the zoom climb, the aircraft slowed to 75 knots for maximum noise reduction as it eased into the assigned altitude, as if the maneuver were choreographed. Then he placed the throttle in the quiet detent. The reduction gearing was immediately noticeable. As the short but wide variable pitch prop adjusted to maintain altitude and 65 knots at just above idle RPM, the Wraith slipped naturally into glider mode. The only thing the two men heard was the sound of their own breathing in their noise-canceling headsets and their helmets. Looks like the FARC having a celebration, Lynch said. I see about 15 people. Orbit here while I get this on tape. Roger. After 3 turns, Lynch said, This is BS. They're just shooting the shit. Duncan, run the throttle up to 3,500 and quickly back to idle. Point the nose at them. That's good. On my mark. Mark. The sudden power change significantly yawed the aircraft before it returned to trimmed flight. The propeller blades propagated low-frequency noise toward the ground, but nothing from the heavily muffled engine. Let's see what they do, if anything, Lynch said. Less than 5 seconds later, the forward-looking infrared's video recording caught the collective surprise of the group of narco-terrorists. Each ghostly image tried to discern the low-frequency growling sound and from where it could have originated. As if given an order, all the men grabbed weapons and ran single file through the jungle. The FLIR caught the white images of their heat signatures and the arcs of cigarettes thrown into the night as they raced down a jungle path. Well, I didn't expect that, Lynch said, nonplussed. That's an unusual response. Usually, if they think it's an airplane operating without lights, they shoot toward the noise. Now what are they doing? The FLIR traced 10 men running down the path, who slowed as they approached a large structure on the hillside. The men took defensive positions around the makeshift hut. Lynch lifted his head suddenly, narrowed his eyes, and whispered, Something doesn't make sense with that response. He switched to the electro-optical sensor, hoping for a better view, then switched back to infrared. As Duncan kept the aircraft in a tight 30-degree right turn, the FLIR recorded the terrorists looking into the distance, waiting for another visual or oral cue. It was a game of cat and mouse, Lynch scanned the mountaintop. The fire was out, though the embers still burned brightly in the flare. Three remaining images walked toward the hut. That's really odd. What is? Duncan didn't have a sensor repeater among the three multifunction displays in HUD and had to rely on the old spook's commentary. I wasn't sure at first, but I think we know where a batch of hostages is located. Take it up 500 feet. I want to see if we can get better imagery through the roof of that hut. Hunter gently zoomed to the requested altitude, careful not to create any whistling of a deflected flight control. The aircraft was specially designed to be noiseless, with conformal antennae and retractable landing gear, but as was demonstrated during low-level flight trials, large deflections of flight controls, even at idle speeds, could create a medium-range whistle that was audible over a mile at night. Before a Y-03A went on a mission in Vietnam, the aircraft would fly 300 feet over the maintenance shack. If the maintainers heard whistles, rattles, or other noises, the pilot brought the aircraft back, and maintenance placed duct tape or aluminum speed tape on loose parts of the airframe. After several flights, the maintenance workers knew where the problems were, and they taped those noisemakers before every flight, so the overhead noise check became an afterthought. 007 sported several strips of black duct tape. Right there. I can just make out 10, 12 bodies. Looks like they're against the walls. Probably their hands and feet are tied. That's a great set of heat signatures through that thatched roof. We'll know more when we analyze the tape. Lynch cross-checked the aircraft's GPS coordinates with the FLIR's symbology and pressed a few commands on the touchscreen of the multifunction display panel. X marks the spot. The GPS coordinates were imprinted on the videotape. After orbiting for 10 minutes, the two men watched the FARC men laugh and joke with each other as they relaxed their defensive posture and returned up the hill. 2 minutes later, they lit a smaller fire, while two guards remained at either ends of the hostage hut. Lynch gave Hunter a vector to depart the location and headed to Cristobal via the river and port. 30 minutes later, Lynch placed his hand on the stick, shook it slightly, and said, "My plane." Duncan responded by releasing the controls and putting both hands up for the man behind him to see. "Your airplane." "I'll call the chief and tell him we located their targets." Lynch switched from interphone to radio. "Lasco, November X-ray 777 Lima Sierra." "November X-ray 777 Lima Sierra, go ahead." "Roger, Lasco. I think we're going to need 1 to 2 hotel rooms for the night. Can you have a van pick us up?" "Copy that, November X-ray 777 Lima Sierra. 1 to 2 hotel rooms. I'll pass the message to the Sofitel." "Roger, Lasco. Thanks for your help, sir. November X-ray 777 Lima Sierra out." He switched back to interphone. "Okay, Duncan, we'll do a little low level over the river. I'd like to find a drug lab or two, maybe find a submarine, then we'll head back to the airport. I want some video of oil tankers and oil storage tanks. You can take it home after that." "Roger." Once Lynch made out the Saldana River draining into the Caribbean Sea, he banked hard to the right and pulled the throttle to idle to slowly descend the Y-03A to 2000 AGL, paralleling the Magdalena River. After 15 minutes of near blackness, Lynch shouted, "Your airplane." "My airplane. I think we have a lab at 3 o'clock. Spin it, please." He slewed the FLIR to the area that flashed in his NVGs. "Nice job, sir. Coming around. Give me a vector. Check your 9 o'clock, about 3 fingers above the tree line. I could barely pick it up in my NVGs. I almost missed it. Now it looks like a flare in our FLIR." "Still no joy." "Oh, there it is. Tally-ho. Nice catch, sir. Man, you wouldn't have been able to see that if you were directly overhead. We were at the exact right slant angle. Check altitude and let's orbit here. I want to see if I can discern what's going on." "Greg, 12 o'clock. I think it's a gunboat coming upriver. Riverine patrol?" "Let me see." Lynch swung the FLIR to the vessel in the middle of the river and zoomed the image. "I'd say it's a Colombian Navy gunboat. I can make out its ensign waving on the stern. I'm recording this. What do you want to bet they power right by the drug lab? Your next modification should be a repeater for that FLIR. Should be able to dump the video onto one of these screens. I'll see about that once we get the old girl home. Yes, Colombian Navy. Looks to be just patrolling. Shit, did you see that? 3 IR flashes. Did that drug lab just signal the gunboat? Is that really a gunboat?" Lynch was completely focused on the FLIR display. "Check your speed. Take her down another 1,000 feet. I want a closer look." Hunter pulled the throttle to idle and reduced the pitch on the propeller. The glider was reluctant to descend, and Hunter was afraid of using speed brakes or spoilers for fear of creating a whistle. "That's very strange," Lynch said. "They're going up the little tributary that feeds into the river. Seems like they're expected. Maybe it's the National Police at the drug lab, and this is a coordinated op? Or maybe the Colombian Navy is corrupt and is in on it. Or maybe you're too cynical. Take it down another 500 feet. Verify 500 AGL? For the moment, I want to see if I can get some high-granularity video. I want to see if I can tell who's on the boat or who's at the lab. Mark this avenue of approach on GPS. We have time for only a pass or two." There was no moon, so the area was absolutely dark. Hunter smiled. His pulse quickened. He knew the altitude at which a human could detect the YO-3A was still top secret. He concentrated on maintaining the correct altitude and kept some level of situational awareness with respect to the terrain. He strayed over the target, but away from the gun line. Army YO-3A crews did that every night in Vietnam, sometimes lower if they believed the sound of running water would mask their approach to the target. Purposely flying into small arms range in an unarmored, unprotected airplane is usually fatal. Lynch cursed under his breath. No one's facing the camera. He requested a closer, lower observation altitude for the final run of videotaping. Okay, I believe we can get away with a quick, low-level pass. Shoot the video and get the hell out of here. Roger, 75 feet. You're incredible, Lynch. This is exactly why UAVs can't cut it in this environment. Just don't hit the spoilers or you'll flip us into the river. These guys don't like having their picture taken. The flare suggests they still have the boat engine running, and they shouldn't be able to hear us. We'll be okay. But if I say run, get us the hell out of here. Can you get a little closer? Roger, passing 150 for 75. Hunter dipped the wing and added a little rudder. And, sir, you're a little closer. Any closer, and I'm afraid we'll hit something. Steady. Smile, shitheads. Come on. That's the ticket. Oh, shit. That's Manny. They're loading packages onto the boat. Get us out of here. Let's go to 2,000 feet and watch. Roger, 2,000. Greg, what's that at 1 o'clock? I see a light source where there shouldn't be one. Okay, flare coming around at 1 o'clock. Searching. Searching. Check 2 o'clock on the waterline, 2 fingers on the right. Tally-ho. Shit, Hunter, you found a sub. Dumb fuck is using his flashlight to get aboard the thing. That's incredible. Reminds me of the night activity at the Texas border. Everyone couldn't believe how much activity goes on there at night completely undetected. I marked it with GPS. Won't be hard to find again. Back to Manny and his band of merry men. Lynch aimed the flare back at the lab and the boat for the maneuver. So far, it doesn't look like they know we're here. I won't press our luck. Hunter increased the pitch control lever and began a gentle climb. Leveling off at 2,000 AGL, he asked, "So, who's Manny?" "Admiral Manuel Vasquez, Colombia's version of Chief of Naval Operations. That looked like he was supervising the loading of bundles of cocaine. I have a hard time thinking he's on the take. Shit, I thought he was a good one. When I was chief of station, we gave him a bunch of intel." 30 minutes later, the gunboat pulled out of the tributary and headed back the way it came. "Follow them," Lynch said. "My pleasure." Hunter flew S-turns to keep from overrunning the gunboat. An hour later, the vessel docked at what appeared to be a naval installation at the mouth of the Saldana. No one took anything off the boat. "Let's head back to the field. We have to get this taped to the COS. After taking a circuitous route to the airfield, which allowed Lynch to tape FLIR images of oil tankers and tankers in port, Hunter landed expertly and taxied quickly to an open hangar at the far end of the field. Once the propeller stopped, he opened the clamshell canopy, and the two men stepped out of the cockpits and climbed down to the ground. The two main maintenance crew hooked a tow bar to the tailwheel and guided the little aircraft into the hangar, where the wings would be removed and the aircraft readied for shipment in its 40-foot sea container. Lynch, the first one off the plane, handed a VCR tape to the awaiting Bogota chief of station. "John, this is probably what you're looking for. I'd like a copy for my files. Duncan, I'll see you back at the hotel. I'll ring your room after I debrief." "That's incredible work, Greg," said the COS. Bogota newspapers reported the freeing of 12 hostages in an isolated jungle area where they were thought to have spent the last 15 weeks. 10 men were killed in a shootout with National Police, and 3 men were charged with training FARC members in bomb-making and kidnapping. the same day the hostages were rescued, a radio station received a statement from the FARC. The group claimed it was holding 9 people for ransom, in addition to other hostages for a prisoner exchange. The Colombian authorities reportedly received satellite footage, probably supplied by the CIA, of the hostages' location. Other articles reported the Armada Nacional de la República de Colombia commander, Admiral Manuel Eduardo Vasquez, suddenly retired for medical reasons. The Colombian National Police and the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency didn't take action against the cocaine submarine, opting to monitor the vessel and the drug smugglers' activities before raiding the area 2 weeks later. Officials were astounded at the level of technology incorporated into the semi-submersible. After the sub was secured and 7 men were taken into custody, an American film crew was brought in to reenact the takedown of the Volvo-powered 100-foot-long vessel. 2 American businessmen flew out of Bogota 2 days later on American Airlines Flight 2170, first class. Surveillance video of the travelers going through ticketing and security couldn't positively identify the men, as if the two knew exactly where the surveillance cameras were located. Hunter returned to his job with the U.S. Border Patrol in Texas, and Lynch returned to his office home near Annapolis. 007's container arrived at the port of Baltimore at the end of the month and was transported to a storage facility near the airport in Easton, Maryland. It would be another 3 months before the Special Access Program, known as WRAITH, would again be activated by the Director of Central Intelligence. Book 1 Chapter 1 0900, December 7th, 1984. Trawing 2 Conference Room, Naval Air Station, Kingsville, Texas. First Lieutenant Duncan Hunter, United States Marine Corps, and his fellow about-to-be newly minted naval aviators marched into a classroom for out-processing. The 6 sailors and 1 Marine officer sat around the conference table. Before them were file folders and mounds of paper. Hunter didn't wait to be told to take a seat. The others followed his lead. 1 minute later, a Navy yeoman wearing a form-fitting dark blue dress uniform, resplendent with ribbons, badges, and pins, entered the room and began her spiel. "Gentlemen, I'm Petty Officer Gentry. I'm here to help you process off the air station and get you on your way to your next duty station. Who needs a pen?" 6 sailors raised their hands. "The first thing we'll do is fill out a standard Form 86, a questionnaire for national security positions. You must fill this out in its entirety before you receive your orders. The Defense Security Service will conduct a background investigation on you, since you'll be coming into contact with sensitive information at your new duty station. Lieutenant Hunter, it seems you're the special one today. Maybe it's a Marine thing. We need 2 copies of your fingerprints and some additional paperwork for DSS to complete a single-scope background investigation." Lieutenant Hunter looked into the blue eyes of the short-haired petty officer, silently questioning the rationale for the additional paperwork. She dropped 2 blue FBI standard Form 87s in front of him and handed out white OPM SF-87s to the sailors. Deep in thought and concern, Hunter tried to understand why some of the naval officers were going to fly more sophisticated aircraft than he, like the EP-3 signal intelligence gathering and EA-6 jamming aircraft, and those pilots only had to fill out 1 white card. 30-year-old Phantoms were a dying breed. They were being replaced by the more capable and agile FA-18A, and Hunter was the last F-4 pilot in the training pipeline. After everyone had his fingerprint cards, Petty Officer Gentry said, "Lieutenant Hunter, please be careful filling out those FS-87s. They're the only 2 I have. F-B-I. Either you've been very naughty, or I guess you'll be doing something special." 6 sailors leaned inward to look at the blue fingerprint cards, while Hunter's eyes shot up toward the yeoman, who smiled and gave him a quick wink. Chapter 2 1300, February 25th, 1985. Sub-Basement 3, Central Intelligence Agency, Washington, D.C. The man in the gray suit and dark tie entered the access code into the programmable keypad, pressed down on the door latch, and entered the skiff. From under his arm, he withdrew a jumbo brown craft envelope and tossed it on the work table. Slicing through the double-wrapped cover with a sharp box cutter, he removed most of the thick package from the FBI, immediately removing the heavy clip from the 2-inch thick stack of documents. The man scanned the blue fingerprint card that had been processed, stamped, and approved by the FBI. Several 10-panel urine screens were stamped negative, showing no trace or history of amphetamines, barbiturates, cannabis, cocaine, or opiate use during the last 10 years. A heavily marked-up questionnaire for national security positions provided the backbone for the 55 DSS investigators' interviews of the subject's acquaintances, friends, co-workers, and family, as well as copies of military, medical, and school records. The man reached into the jumbo sleeve and spilled out 2 dozen photographs clipped together.
"Let's see what you look like."
He adjusted his necktie before flipping through the black-and-white 8x10 photographs of the subject in his Marine uniform, in a racquetball court, or engaged in other physical activity. He stopped at the color photograph of the subject in a flight suit, standing on the boarding ladder of a Navy jet, helmet in hand, with a broad smile. He had short, dark hair with no receding hairline, and was a handsome, lean, mean, fighting Marine Corps machine.
"Probably the perfect build, weight, and height for a fighter pilot. Not a bad little hero shot," the man said.
After 3 hours reading and taking notes in the margins, he reached across the table for a large stamp and ink pad. Flipping open the metal cover, he took the stamp and pounded the pad 3 times before centering the stamp at the bottom of the cover sheet. "Approved" in red letters remained on the sheet from the ink transfer. He initialed the page and separated the sections of the package before placing them into an accordion file folder, removed the top from a black ink marker, and wrote Hunter, Duncan, USMC across the top of the file flap. He slid back his chair, picked up the file folder, and placed it with similar folders in a 4-drawer safe. Those folders were culled from thousands of subjects who took a battery of simple aptitude tests across America during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The CIA's Science and Technology Division was interested in the outcome of one single test. How quickly could a subject balance 16 penny nails on the head of another? Under 3 minutes was noteworthy. Balancing 16 nails on the head of one under 60 seconds made the National Clandestine Service want to take a look at the feasibility of recruitment. Hunter, Duncan, USMC, was the first person in 5 years to break the code and deliver the solution in 58 seconds. The man charged with identifying unusually capable, talented people for unique and time-sensitive special access programs closed the safe labeled 17 nails, spun the dial, and left the tiny skiff. Chapter 3 0700, October 10th, 1996, Del Rio International Airport, Del Rio, Texas. The overnight thunderstorms blew out just in time. Duncan Hunter sat back in his chair and stared into the distance as dozens of maquiladoras on the other side of the Rio Grande disappeared over the horizon and into the haze. Aircraft mechanics slogged through the hangar dripping with sweat. In a couple hours, it would be showtime. It was another humid day in Del Rio, and the U.S. Border Patrol's Director of Aircraft Maintenance would soon be on his way to the other end of the airfield, either to bring Border Patrol aviation into the 20th century, or watch it lapse back into a glorified flying club, or die altogether. The uncertainty made Hunter nervous. For a former Marine fighter pilot, the feeling was new and a bit unsettling. There was a career resting on how well the presentation went. Depending on who one talked with, it was not a good fit having a former fighter pilot and aircraft maintenance officer with a couple of graduate degrees as the Border Patrol's new aircraft maintenance director. It was an odd choice for a new civil servant with little to no civil aviation experience. Law enforcement aviation and FAA regulations were completely different beasts than military flight and maintenance operations. But the GAO report suggested either the Border Patrol gets some adult leadership to turn its aviation program around, or it would be shut down. Not many applied for the job. Hunter was a surprise selection. Within the first hour of his first day, he met the crusty old chief pilot for the first time. Charles Rodriguez jabbed a finger into Hunter's chest and spat, "Who the fuck do you know in the Border Patrol?" Taken completely by surprise by the outburst from the short, heavily wrinkled man in a flight suit, Hunter coolly replied, "You try that again, and I'll break your finger. I don't know anyone in the Border Patrol." He saw a rectangular name tag, a Border Patrol aviation patch, and a shoulder holster containing a 9mm Beretta. Holstering his finger, Charles snapped, "Bullshit! You couldn't have gotten this job without knowing someone in the Border Patrol. Who the fuck is it?" Hunter debated his response.
Is that how you got your job, Charles? Who'd you blow to get it? I don't know anyone in the Border Patrol. However, I do know the Attorney General.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?